Thank you for those kind exaggerations. It's exciting to be here with the Chevra. There's something nostalgic for me. The last couple of years I've had the chance to come to Eretz Yisrael and spend time face-to-face with fellows who are learning in various yeshivas in Eretz Yisrael. So at the moment, that's not an option. So I get to join you only vicariously, but Baruch Hashem, Rabbeinu Shlomo is good to us. And at least he gives us other ways to connect. And I'd love to connect through Talmud Torah. As Rabbi Ziering said, Agada is a topic that's close to both of our hearts. And we did connect a couple of weeks ago over particularly the Ramchal's approach to Agada, which is captured in an essay, a short essay that he wrote, thinking about Agada. Maybe we'll get to that a little bit later. But I actually want to open up by looking at a very, very famous Agada. Perhaps one of the most famous Agadas that speaks to a story in Chumash. Let's take a look right here. So here we are, Shabbos Daf Pei Ches Amud Aleph. I understand that the yeshiva this year is learning Bava Basra and Sota. Hopefully we will come over the course of our time together to one or both of those Masechtas. But let's open up with exceptionally famous Agada in Masechta Shabbos. Masechta Shabbos here, Peches, Peites, thereabouts, the end of the Peis are the Agada Sugya of Kabbalah Satorah, of Har Sinai of Kabbalah Satorah, and here we are near the top of Peches Zemanal, at the two dots. Vayisyatzvu besachta sahar, Gemara comments, this is a medrash, it's a piece of Torah Shvapet that's built around the pasuk and organized al seder apsukim. By Yisyatzvu b'sachta sahar, the Jewish people are there at the foothills of the mountain in preparation for Mamar Har Sinai. Amar Rabbi Avidimi bar Chama bar Chasa. So the Amor Avidimi comments, Milamed, this pasuk teaches us Shekafa Kadosh Baruch Aleim Esahar Kegigis. Rebbeinu Shlom turned the mountain, turned Har Sinai over their heads like a barrel. The Amar Lahem, Rebbeinu Shlom says to them, Atem mekabelim haTorah mutav. If you're willing to accept the Torah, fantastic. V'im lav, and if not, sham tek v'rasam. You will be buried on site. There's a mountain, it sounds like, suspended over your heads, so it's do or die. Kadosh Baruch Hu made us an offer we couldn't refuse, and indeed, we did not refuse. And then the Gemara goes on to say that really put a limit on the quality of our Kabbalah Satorah. Modar Rabbalah writes that we really accept the Torah under coercion. And the Gemara goes on to say, with Abarava comments, Afapichin Hadr Kiblu B'mei HaChashverosh. Our Kabbalah Satorah is no longer so limited. It's no longer bounded by the fact that we accepted it under coercion, because 1,000 years later, almost exactly 1,000 years later, at the end of the story of Purim, we accepted the Torah more fully without coercion. Kimu v'kiblu ha-Yehudim. Kimu masha kiblu kvar. We recertified, we reaffirmed what we had already previously accepted. So what are we supposed to make of this Gemara? Obviously, the content is pretty significant. This is central. This is a very central sugya in general, the sugya of Kabbalah Satorah. It speaks to all of Torah and all of mitzvahs. This passage in particular, this Agada in particular, speaks to the quality, the extent of our entire connection to Halacha. That our acceptance of Halacha was originally under coercion, but 1,000 years later we completed it. We were mekayim the more fully the initially, imperfect, incomplete, I should say, Kabbalah. We were mekayim in the days of Achashverosh. So there's a lot going on in terms of content. But before we even get into content, just a question or two, just about the process. Question for the Chevra. Melamed Shekafra HaKadosh Baruch Hu Aleim Har Kegigis. This pasuk teaches me Rebbeinu Shlom holds the mountain over our heads. How does this pasuk teach that? Pray tell. This format is so hard. I wish I could could meet you on a face to face and get to know you and get to learn some names. But feel free to speak. I know the technology isn't perfect, but feel free to speak up. Feel free to unmute and to speak up. Share your name if you'd like. Well, how does the pasuk teach me anything? Where's the gigas in the pasuk? Where's the barrel in this pasuk? So, any thoughts? Any thoughts about from anyone in the room? The melame. Where do you see anything in this pasuk? There's nothing about a barrel. Where did Chazal see? Where do Avidimi see it?
I would have to assume from the word kachbis, which is like underneath almost.
Right. I think you're hitting something important, Yosef. The Pshuto Shal Mikra, they were at the foothills of the mountain. The simple reading of the pasuk, it means they were gathered around the mountain. They're right near the bottom of the mountain, next to the bottom of the mountain, Besachta Sahar. They're at the foothills of the mountain. They weren't far away. But, yeah.
I have a thought.
Sure.
Could the pasuk be establishing some form of hierarchical thing with the Jewish people at the bottommost part of the mountain, and Hashem and Moshe at least was on the top of the mountain, and Hashem was, you know, somewhat on the top of the mountain as well, and there was some form of hierarchical nature that's being established here with the Jewish people under Hashem.
That's fascinating. What's your name?
Yehonatan.
I like that suggestion, that there's a visual. The Torah is drawing our attention to this vertical visual that the Jewish people are below, and Moshe, and certainly HaKadosh Baruch Hu, is above them, as it were, and that speaks to that visual metaphor captures a certain hierarchy. Yeah, that's a great point. And it all comes back to the word tachtis. See, the simple sense, tachtis, again, is the foothills of the mountain. They were next to the bottom of the mountain. But presumably, what Rav Avdimi is the wrinkle in the language of the pasuk that Rav Avdimi is sensitive to, I think, is that there are other ways to say that the Jewish people were next to the mountain. You could have said they were Eitz Alahar, they were Al Hahar, they were Liad Hahar. The Besachta Sahar is a somewhat unusual way of describing where they were. And so, what Rav Avdimi is capturing, look, there's a Gemara. A good 25 block earlier, Masechah Shabbos on Daf Samach Gimel, is one of the places where the Gemara makes the comment that Ein Mikra Yotze Midei Pshuto, that the Ein Mikra Yotze Midei Pshuto, that the Torah is simultaneous. Any given pasuk in Chumash will be simultaneously conveying multiple layers of meaning. It's conveying the drasha and it's conveying the pshat. The same pasuk is giving me more than one message. And here we get a great opportunity to see how that's working. Pshuto shel mikra, they were standing next to the mountain. But the choice of language that the Torah employs, we could have chosen a different, smoother way of putting it. So the awkwardness, the awkward phrasing is meant to allow Ribbono Shel Olam to piggyback another idea as well. In addition to the fact that they are standing next to the mountain, but there's also this tachas sense, that it's as though they're under the mountain. So how are they under the mountain? So as Yonatan said, there's a hierarchy being conveyed here. Ribbono Shel Olam is on top and Klal Yisrael on bottom. And more sharply, the Rav Avdimi is giving us this vivid image of Klal Yisrael not only under the Ribbono Shel Olam, but Klal Yisrael under the mountain. Now, why are Klal Yisrael under the mountain? So Yonatan is saying, oh, Klal Yisrael under HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we understand what that means, that we're subservient to Ribbono Shel Olam, and we're meant to put our talents and our drives and our capacities at the service of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But what does it mean that we're under the mountain? Under the mountain gives you a sense not just of a moral hierarchy, but that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was ready to quash us with the mountain. HaKadosh Baruch Hu was holding a gun to our heads, as it were. HaKadosh Baruch Hu was holding the mountain over our heads like a barrel, and there's a threat. There's a threat. If we don't accept Torah, we're done. So before we even get into content, just considering the process of the Agada, I think has already drawn our attention to a couple of key points. It's drawn our attention to one of the ways in which Ribbono Shel'olam conveys multiple layers of meaning simultaneously, that the Pshat and the Drash are operating in sync. The Torah is telling me something, Bipshuto, but the way it could have, Torah could have phrased that same Pshuto in various ways, so the particular choice of phrasing, particularly if it's a somewhat awkward phrasing, it intimates that there's a second layer of meaning as well. And it also draws our attention, obviously, and that's sort of the theme that, certainly one of the major themes you've been grappling with for a while, is that one needs to learn Agada seriously. We've been trained, sometimes we're trained more on the halachic sugyas than on the agadic sugyas to learn with care and to learn with an eye for detail. So we need to learn Agada seriously. So now that we've thought about process, let's think about content. So what does this mean? Hashem Baruch Hu holding a mountain over our heads? What's the point? Yeah, Yonatan.
I have a possibility for the reason
for that. Sure.
It could be that so sending at the bottom of the mountain is like the moral hierarchy, and this could be like the physical hierarchy, in that throughout the entire exodus from Egypt, not only kind of positive things for the Jewish people, but here he is. I think it could be taken as here God is kind of showing how he can also do negative things to the Jewish people, and showing his not just his moral high ground, so to say, but also his physical power over the entire universe.
Interesting. So Yonatan's suggesting that the significance of the threat is essentially creating a Yiras HaOnesh. The framework, the matrix of ideas within which Klal Yisrael are going to accept the Torah is understand, as you said, Klal Yisrael have experienced so many chasadim from HaKadosh Baruch Hu over the last number of months, but understand there's onesh as well. Understand HaKadosh Baruch Hu can give sar, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu can also give onesh. And there sometimes can be unpleasant consequences for poor choices. And that was a necessary concept to have in hand in advance of Kabbalah Torah. I think that's an important point. That HaKadosh Baruch Hu is laying out Yiras HaOnesh. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is laying out the notion of Schar V'Onesh. And as you're saying, that's something that had not yet been really a part of their intellectual diet up until this point. Up until this point, it had all been Chesed. Chesedim Tovim. And now we understand sometimes that HaKadosh Baruch Hu may send painful things our way. And those painful things may be a result, a consequence of decisions that we make. That's fascinating. But let me push back. Because if we're going to do this seriously, so then we want to see how does that idea continue through. Because remember, the next line in the Gemara, Rava says, well, there was, this did, the fact that the Torah was accepted with a certain degree of coercion that does limit the quality, the magnitude of our Kabbalah HaTorah, but that limitation was removed 1,000 years later when we were re-mekabel the Torah, when we were mekayim our prior Kabbalah HaTorah, the time of Achashverosh. So the question is, how is Achashverosh, how is Purim in any substantive way a response to this limitation? Kafal and Harkagigas. But 1,000 years later, at the time of Purim, there was a refreshed Kabbalah HaTorah without this limitation. What does that have to do with Purim? So the Gemara did quote, Rava had quoted a pasuk from the Megillah, the end of the Megillah, Kimu v'kiblu ha'yehudim, and he's clearly troubled by that the redundant language. He said, well, Kimu mashi kiblu kvar, but there must be something more to it, contextually. Yeah. What's your name?
Sean Slamowitz.
Sean, yeah?
So I think that there is some parallelism in terms of what's happening to the Jews during the time of Har Sinai that's also simultaneously happening during the Purim story, right? So both stories in terms of location takes place outside of Eretz Yisrael, something that is, right, once we move into Eretz Yisrael, we're kind of in this full completion of sovereignty, right, where we have this relationship with God where we are fully in service of him, right? There's this idea that within the land of Israel is the ideal expression of mitzvot, right? Which is the way in which we express our service to God. So we're kind of in some sense removed from that through the exile that has taken place, that is very similar to the state of mind that the Jews are in right as the time of Harsinai is going about. And the other thing that's happening is there also is this there's this status, or the Jewish people, similar to the story, are in a place where their life is kind of in this state of uncertainty, right? And that they're relating to this higher power that's over them, that has their lives in their hands, and depending on how they act, that's going to determine their reality. It does come. So that's where I think it flips, right? Yeah. So Yosef was. So I was looking at the pasuk that they're bringing in comes at the end, right? So I think that's where the things flipped, right? Whereas with Har Sinai, the original the state that they're in is coming beforehand, right? And they have to make the decision. Whereas the story of Purim comes right as they're being saved, and that's when the pasuk is coming in that's actually saving them. So that's where I think it flips. Mm. But I think that there is still this similarity that is being expressed in parallel between both events.
So let's unpack some of what you were saying. Number one, you actually looked up the pasuk, and you looked at the content of the pasuk, and that is absolutely critical. Too often, B'nai Yeshiva sort of, let's say, elide over the psukim being quoted, even though the psukim are meant to be the source. Obviously, there's a tremendous amount to be appreciated. The idea will be fully appreciated when you understand its source. It's actually Brisker Rav in his Sefer on Rambam, uses that tool often. Let's look in a halachic context. Let's understand the din more, the nature of the din, the conceptual nature of the din more fully by looking at the Sifra, looking at the Taros Kohanim. Let's see where does this come from, the psukim, and how, and you know, context and how it's phrased and how many different psukim are will often give us a lot of clues to the structure, the conceptual structure of the dinim. And it's going to be true certainly on Gada as well. So I like that you're looking at the pasuk. And you're looking at the context of the pasuk, and you're right, it comes at the end of the story. So you're saying that coming at the end of the story is a different picture than coming earlier on. And you're saying the covenant HaKagigas was after Har Sinai, after Yetzias Mitzrayim, but in advance of Har Sinai.
They both have these similar themes and a similar setup, right? And the receiving of Torah that is being expressed in both of them is happening at different points along the chronology.
Okay, good. Perhaps different points along the chronology. Although we might push back on that a little bit. In other words, in both cases, it's both Kabbalas HaTorah Har Sinai and the Kima V'Kiblu are both post Yeshua. The Kaflin HaKigigas follows after Yetzias Mitzrayim and after Kriyas Yamsuf. But you're right, it's leading up to the story of Mama Harsina and Kabbalas HaTorah. So in the Megillah, it's following the Yeshua from Haman. It's hard to say that this is in advance of the Kabbalah. Well, this is the Kabbalah. This is the Kima V'Kiblu. Unless we go back to context and notice that the more immediate context of this pasuk, on the side you get a little bit, in the more full Ein Mishpat Ner Mitzvah, you'll notice this is the very end of Perek Tes, the very end of the second class, the very end of the Megillah. You'll remember that Perek Tes is largely occupied, Perek Tes of Esther is largely occupied with the halachic portion, as it were, of Megillah's Esther. And the aftermath of the Yeshua, we see the development of the dinim of Purim. What's the content of the Kim of the Kiblu? The Al Pipshuto Kim of the Kiblu is a reference to the Jewish people accepting the Takana of Purim as a permanent Takana, for not only for that generation, but for all generations. V'lo Yavar. This is going to be a permanent part of Halacha, albeit Midrabanan. B'chol shana v'shana, to practice the halachas of Purim and to keep these 2 days, Yudalad and Tesvav of Adar, kichsavam v'chizmanam. So this is the permanent acceptance of the halachas of Purim. The permanent acceptance, let's notice, of a din drabbanan. Of a din drabbanan. So if we're wondering, we might say, like, what does this have to do with Kabbalah Sotar at all? Well, the way in which this is, part of the way in which this is parallel also, to add another layer to what you're saying, is that this was a second Kabbalah Sotar in the sense that Al Pi Pshuto, this pasuk is describing the Jewish people being mekabel the dinim drabbanan of Purim. So this is another Kabbalah of a particular mitzvah. Now, what Rava is saying is that this is more than merely, I don't mean that in a demeaning sense, but I mean that in the literal C.S. Lewis sense, this is more than merely a Kabbalah of Purim. It's also a re-Kabbalah, a kiyum of the prior Kabbalah of all of Torah. Where did Rava see that? Once again, from sensitivity to the language of the Pasuk. Why did it say kiyumu v'kiblu ayyudim? She said kiblu ayyudim. Kiblu ayyudim aleim v'alzaram. They were makabel, the Yom Tov of Purim, and all attendant halachas. Why the kiyumu v'kiblu? So Rava is zeroing in, and that language sounds like there was a Kabbalah, but there was also a kiyum. And if you've learned Maseches Nedarim, so in the end of Maseches Nedarim, we sometimes use the terminology of kiyum to be a further acceptance, a further reinforcement of a pre-existing obligation. A woman takes a neder, it's already binding, her husband might be mekayim the neder, and now it's locked in place to an even greater extent. So Rava appears to be reading the word kiyumu in this late biblical or early rabbinic Hebrew. This is Shiva Sion. This is a Galus Bavel Sefer. So l'kayim is being used in a similar sense. It's re-strengthening a Kabbalah. So how is it they were Mekayim, they're also Mekabel? So he says they're Mekayim the old and Mekabel the new. Okay, that's the Rava's work in the Pasuk. Now let's think about the content of what's going on. So we learn here. Excuse me. We learn here, Rav Avdimi points out that Besachta, the language, the sensitivity to language, Besachta Sahar, there's a play on words. It means that the foothills, but the choice of terminology, Tachtis, as opposed to Eitzel, or some other perhaps smoother word, indicates there was also a Tachas. There was an element of being under the mountain, which implies, for Rav Avdimi, coercion. Coercion. And then the counterpoint to that, Rava says, is the kimu v'kiblu, that the time when the Jewish, at the point 1,000 years or so later, when the Jewish people are makabel, the new din drabbanan of Purim, that concomitantly was also a reinforcement, a kiyum of Mamon Har Sinai, of their Kabbalah of the dinim daraisa. Then, of course, we wonder, okay, so you have the language in the psukim, but what's the content of one have to do with the other? I know you were talking before about process. But I want to, I know Jonathan, you were, Yonatan, and Sean, you were both talking about process before. Where lies in the story? But let's just give me a moment. I just want to think for a moment about content. Is there something about the story of Pesach and Shavuos versus the story of Purim? So think about the historical context here. So we were talking before about they're both, in both situations, there's a Kabbalah's HaTorah that follows Yeshua, so that's a similarity. You were pointing out differences, perhaps, in terms of at what point does the Kabbalah's HaTorah happen vis-a-vis the Yeshua. But let's also think about some radical differences between the story of Pesach and Shavuos on the one hand, and the story of Purim on the other hand.
And one of the relatively obvious one of like open miracle versus like not open miracle, I guess.
Right. The Yosef points out that perhaps we think in terms of Ramban's closing comment to Parshas Bo. Right, that Yetzias Mitzrayim is an epitome of Nisim Niglam. But as Ramban points out, we're meant to, a greater spiritual accomplishment is not only to notice HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the open miracles, in the rare razzle-dazzle moments, but for that to lead me to then a more sophisticated accomplishment of noticing HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the everyday, you know, in the more subtle Nisim Nistarim. Yeah, question. What's your name?
David Lifter.
Yeah, David. How are you?
Okay. I'm also just thinking now with what Booth was saying also, insofar as how the Gemara was saying that the open miracles versus the non-open miracles, and then the way that they had to accept it of being like, after the open miracles, it was like forced on them versus the non-open miracles, the not being forced. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, I'm just thinking like, I mean, after having like experienced so many miracles, it's kind of impossible to not go that way insofar as like that impossibility of having to accept it. Versus when it's not open, like you could say things are more by chance, by nature, how others...
Wow, that's a very, very sharp point. I want to take that and run with it a little bit, and then Sean will come back to you. So you're making the point that the Nisim Niglim mean that HaKadosh Baruch was more obvious, which means it's harder to say no. As a matter of fact, the Maharal points out that let's look at the next piece of the Gemara. Chizkiya suddenly comments, and at first glance, it's hard to understand the continuity, unless it's just another comment about Har Sinai. My dichsim mishamayim mishmata din eretz yara v'shakta. HaKadosh Baruch Hu from the heavens lets us hear about Torah, perhaps a reference to Kabbalah, HaTorah, to Mamon Har Sinai. The land yara v'shakta was frightened and then was calm. Well, I'm already imposing some what the Gemara is going to say. It was frightened and it was calm. The Chizkiya points out that seems like an oxymoron. Which one was it? Frightened or calm? Those are cross purposes. So the answer is no. First this, then that. B'tchila yara ulv'sof shakta. First the land was frightened and then subsequently was serene. Why? So he goes on to explain, quoting Reish Lakish, that the existence of the universe is predicated on Kabbalah Satorah. Perhaps as Ramchal quotes in many places, Rabbi Kaplan points out, he's quoting Rav Sadia Gaon in Emunah V'Deos, that the purpose of the creation of Olam Hazeh was to enable, to give us the opportunity to earn our Olam Haba, to give us an Olam HaNisayon, you know, a universe. Olam Haba is a context which the ultimate divine engineer calibrated, optimized for delivery of pleasure. Olam Haba is the Olam HaTanug. Olam Hazeh is optimized not as the Olam HaTanug, but as the Olam HaNisayim, the ultimate arena of challenge. A concept that the Ramchal develops at greater or lesser length at the beginning of a number of Sfarim, beginning of Mesilas Yesharim, Perek Aleph. Develops it in Derech Hashem, develops it in Das Tfunos. I'm told he also develops it at the beginning of Klach Pesachei Chachma, for those who are Kabbalists. And so the existence, it's logical, and indeed that's where Reish Lakish teaches us here, that the continued existence of Olam Hazeh was predicated on Kabbalah Satorah. Without Kabbalah Satorah, Olam Hazeh loses its significance. If there's no Torah, then there's no Nisayon, and then there's no need for this platform for Nisyonos, this arena of Nisyonos, which is Olam Hazeh. So Chizkiya, immediately after this discussion about Kafel and Arkei Gigas, Gemara quotes Chizkiya saying that the universe, as it were, was tense initially, until they heard that the Klal Yisrael Mekabel the Torah. Wondering, on the edge, the universe was, as it were, on the edge of its seat. Are we going to say yes or no? If we say no, the universe, Olam Hazeh, is done. But then subsequently, Shakta. Yara, but then Shakta. We said yes, the universe will have an ongoing Kiyum. So Maharal says, how all these three pieces hang together? Kaflei Harkri Gigas, Kimu Mashakiblu Kvar, and Yara Vishakta. So Maharal says, Chaim Friedlander quotes this in one of his essays on Purim. He quotes the Maharal at the beginning of his Sefer Or Chadash. He says, Maral says, it's so beautiful. I know Rabbi Ziering has shared with you extensively, he tells me, the approach of the Rambam and others to understand that often Chazal in Agada in particular, are speaking in metaphor. So the Maral says, that's what Kafle HaKigigas means. Yeah, I said before, when I was talking about Kadosh Baruch Hu holding a mountain over our heads like a barrel, Kadosh Baruch Hu held a gun to our heads. Now, you probably didn't think I meant that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created suddenly a massive howitzer that was suspended in the air pointed at Klal Yisrael. I mean, certainly as Rambam and Ramban both point out in numerous places, HaKadosh Baruch Hu can do any miracle he wants, but he doesn't always choose to do miracles. God certainly has the capacity to create an enormous gun and suspend in the air over Klal Yisrael, but you understood that I meant that as a figure of speech. HaKadosh Baruch Hu held the gun to heads was a way of saying HaKadosh Baruch Hu forced us. Maral says that's what Kafal and HaKigigas means as well. The holding our gun to our heads of 3,000-4,000 years ago was holding a barrel over our heads. It's an expression. It doesn't mean that literally HaKadosh Baruch Hu uprooted the mountain and it was suspended over our heads. To be clear, HaKadosh Baruch Hu certainly can do that. Belief in God as the Borei Olam is logically equivalent to the understanding that God can do any miracle he wishes. But it doesn't mean that he always chooses to do miracles. As a matter of fact, as both Rambam and Ramban point out, HaKadosh Baruch Hu made the decision, it's clear, HaKadosh Baruch Hu made the decision and created Olam Hazeh, it's clear from observation and it's clear from our Masorah, that the Ribbono Shel Olam chose in creating the universe to create a mathematical, scientific, patterned universe that would be generally governed by the patterns of physics and chemistry that he himself divinely set up. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu can do any nes he wants, but rarely chooses to do nisim. So the Maral says, it doesn't mean that literally there was a mountain held over heads. It means that HaKadosh Baruch Hu forced us. It's a figure of speech. HaKadosh Baruch Hu held a gun to our heads. HaKadosh Baruch Hu held a barrel to our heads. It means that HaKadosh Baruch Hu forced us. And how, as you mentioned before, not through physical threat. If you don't say yes, you will be physically destroyed. This mountain will crush you to bits. It was instead something far more positive and something far more profound and intrinsic. HaKadosh Baruch Hu made it clear to us. Maral says, you know, by design, in order for Olam Hazeh to be that effective Olam HaNisayon, Olam Hazeh, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, chooses to hide himself, to make himself inobvious, so that we are able to make real choices, so we have their free will to do the right thing or the wrong. If HaKadosh Baruch Hu allowed himself to be evident to us at all times, you know, we would be mere robots, morally, because it would be so obvious what the right thing to do is. Mashal mahadavar dome. You're going on a tiul, and you're going along an escarpment. There's a ridge that follows along the face of the mountain. So as you're hiking along the ridge, you know, on down to your right or down to your left for quite some time, for hundreds of meters, if not more, there's a very steep drop. So in theory, you have the Bechir Chavshis to walk off that ridge. But if you're in a mentally stable place, you never would make that choice. I mean, in theory, you physically could walk off the side. But you're obviously not going to, because your instinct for self-preservation will make sure that you stay on the path and you don't get hurt. So at the time of Matan Torah, Maral says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu for a moment pulled away the curtains. HaKadosh Baruch Hu for a brief moment allowed us to see reality as it actually is. And for a brief moment, it was self-evident to Klal Yisrael that the only sensible path forward is to accept the Torah. That's just the right way to live. Much like the fellow on the escarpment who realizes, of course I'm not going to walk off this side. That would be absurd. Of course I'm going to stay on the trail and keep myself safe and healthy. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu allowed us for a moment to see with clarity HaKadosh Baruch Hu part of the mechitzos. And we saw, of course this is the right thing to do. The HaKadosh Baruch Hu forced us, but not in a negative way. But rather, as you said before, this is Pesach. This is a time, this was a period in Jewish history of great Gilui Hashem. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the pinnacle of that was this moment of Kafnei Har Chagigas. It was an extraordinarily positive moment. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it was a moment of unparalleled clarity of perception on the part of Klal Yisrael in terms of the reality of Olam Hazeh. The moral reality of Olam Hazeh, for that one moment, of course, there was no choice but to say yes. It would be absurd to say no. It was obvious in that moment that to not accept Torah wholeheartedly would be just self-destructive. It's rarely, it's never so obvious to us as it was then. By design, by divine design, in order for this world to be Alman Yisayon. For that one moment, though, HaKadosh Baruch Hu made it so clear so that we would make the right choice. Because, as Chizkiah goes on to say, the entire universe was riding on it. And as a matter of fact, what Chizkiah describes, the Yara Veshakta, the fact that the universe depends on this, that's exactly what HaKadosh Baruch Hu allowed us to see. That was the Kafalim HaKigis. It doesn't mean that literally there was a mountain suspended over our heads. It's far more sophisticated than that. It's far more profound than that. Again, not Chalila to say that God could not have done that. He could have done the nace of plucking the mountain from the ground. But it means something far more sophisticated than that. And by the way, now we understand Kimu v'Kibla. I think that's what you were driving at before. The Kabbalah, in what way was the Kabbalah of the mitzvahs of Purim a Kiyum? In what way did that fill the gap from 1,000 years earlier? Exactly as you said, because now we were reaccepting a mitzvah without Gilui Hashem. Reaccepting a mitzvah in a period of Hester. The capacity to know HaKadosh Baruch Hu is inobvious. Wow. So that statement by Klal Yisrael, that even though HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not self-evident, but we can discern his fingerprints in the story of, in the Nisim Nistarim of Purim, in the psychodynamics of the Persian court, we see Yad Hashem at work, and we express that by wholeheartedly embracing a new mitzvah drabbanan of Purim, that was also a kiyum of the prior Kabbalah HaTorah. It was now reinforcing and deepening our Kabbalah HaTorah up until this point of the mitzvahs d'oraisa, and now much richer, are now no longer limited to, well, we had no choice because it was so obvious. Yeah, thoughts, questions? And let's go first with someone who hasn't yet spoken up. What's your name?
My name is Chaim Zifkin.
Yeah. Chaim, yeah.
You mentioned before that if we all always saw, all the inner workings, whatever, of God and reality and all that, mm-hmm. then we'd just be robots, and therefore we wouldn't, it wouldn't be pleasurable, and we wouldn't, aside from getting into free will or not, but whatever, there wouldn't be free will for lack of, okay. So at that point, then, if what we're saying is that for a moment there was a break in our distorted vision and we saw things how they really are, how is that not intrinsically a taking away of free will and therefore just being robots for the acceptance?
That's a great point, Chaim. That's a great point. Right, you're saying, let's put this in the context of Sota, Masecha Sota, and let's come back to your point. Right, Gemara, believe the beginning of Masecha Sota, Dav Gimel or so, Ein Adam Nechnas, Ein Adam Chote, Ein Nechnas Baruch Shtos. Every chet has an element of insanity. Not enough insanity to actually be legally insane and not liable for your actions, but there's an element of insanity in any chet, which presumably means that if we believe in God and are fully rational, then chet is impossible. Because the cost-benefit analysis never works out. As Mishnah Avos speaks about, b'machashiv, schar mitzvah k'neged hefsed, the hefsed aver k'neged schar. The cost-benefit analysis, it never really makes sense. Not like Pascal's wager, but with a twist. And as all the ephemeral benefit of an Aveira never is worthwhile compared to the eternal cost in Olam Haba. So every chet involves a moment, a degree of irrationality. But you're saying in that moment what you're saying that the Gemara here is saying, according to the Maral, the Gemara in Shabbos Peches, is in that. For that moment, HaKadosh Baruch Hu reduced our Bechir Chavshas. We were like the fellow the mentally healthy, stable fellow who's hiking along an escarpment, who in theory has bechira chafshis to walk off the side, but his instinct for self-preservation would never allow him to do that. Why would I possibly want to? I'll get hurt if not killed if I walk off the side. Of course I'm going to continue on the path. So you're right, Chaim. There was, if not a total suspension, at least a severe reduction in the quality of our Bechira Chafshas. That's exactly what the Gemara says. That's why the Gemara goes on to say, let's take a look back at that Gemara again. Amar of Acha Bar Yaakov, Mikan Moda Rabba La Oraisa. That's why there's a limit on the strength of our Kabbalah's HaTorah, because we didn't really have a choice. And that's why, and it's that gap, it's not that there was no Kabbalah's HaTorah, there was a Kabbalah's HaTorah, but it was missing something. There was a lacuna, there was a hole in the quality of our Kabbalah's HaTorah because it had been under coercion. Again, according to Maral, not the coercion of dread, but the sort of ironic, the coercion of clarity. And that's that gap is being filled by Hadar Kiblu Me'echa Shveirosh. When we had the opportunity to, another opportunity for Kabbalah's HaMitzvahs, and we did it without this sort of overwhelming clarity. In days of Purim, you could have just chalked it up to, you know, that's the way the political cookie crumbles, and we didn't. So that filled that gap that we had been carrying for the first 1,000 years. Exactly.
Yeah, so that's clear, but that actually leads into a question I've been meaning to ask for a bit, but I wanted to wait till like later in the share so we didn't take too much time, because I wasn't sure if it was exactly on point. But you said before, and you just said it again, that there was some sort of, I guess, defect in the original Kabbalah's HaTorah. So what exactly does that mean? Does that mean that every mitzvah that Moshe did, that David did, every carbon that we brought in you know, the first place of Migdash, all that had some sort of defective quality to it, and it wasn't like the greatest level of mitzvah, and therefore we can say that Moshe didn't have the greatest level of perfection of mitzvah? Like, I feel like that's kind of hard to say, right? So what exactly does it mean that there was a defect in the Kabbalah's HaTorah?
Yeah, that is a great question. It's hard to imagine that our mitzvos have a positive quality that those of Moshe and David did not.
Right.
So Rashi says, Rashi has, I think, a more minimalist reading of this. Modar Rabba, Rashi says, on this Gemara, She'im Yasmin Ledin, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu will call as my HaKadosh Baruch Hu judges us. Lama lo kiyamte ma shekibaltem aleichem. For those times when we fall short and we don't perform what we're supposed to, so we have a yesh lachem tshuva, yesh lachem tshuva. We can make an argument, we can mitigate it somewhat. Kiblu bionas, we didn't really accept this out of our free will. But Maral would probably say, I believe, you know, something more comprehensive. And you're right that the quality, you're right that the quality of, it's not just about when we do the wrong thing, you know, we have an argument to make in our defense, but you're right, it's when we're doing the right thing, there is something missing. Moshe Rabbeinu's mitzvahs had thousands of aspects, millions of untold aspects, way beyond what we have. But it is true at the same time that, I'm not sure Moshe Rabbeinu, because Moshe Rabbeinu's Kabbalah's HaTorah may have transcended this. But you are right. The Gemara is saying there's something about mitzvahs after Purim that may be different. And there's a certain positive quality that's added to Kiyum HaMitzvahs after Purim. And the truth is the Gemara, I believe, Masechet Megillah, a remarkably striking Gemara. Gemara comments on, if I remember correctly, it's the opening pasuk of the 22nd parak of Tilim. Lamatzecha al yelas hashachar. Which the Gemara understands as a reference to, ayelas hashachar as a reference to Esther. Gemara understands that Esther recited that parak of Tilim as she's entering into her fateful meeting with Achashverosh. The Gemara wants to know, in what way is Esther comparable to Ayelas HaShachar, to dawn? So the Gemara says something very surprising. The Gemara says, just like dawn is the end of the night, so to Esther is the end of Nisan. This marks the end of the period of Nevuah, more or less the end of the period of Nisan Geluyim. There will be a small Nes Galuy in the story of Hanukkah, but this is the end of the era. And Purim really already marks, as Reb Tzadok discusses, this is the transition from living a life that's focused on experience HaKadosh Baruch Hu Begiloy, towards living life that's focused on experience HaKadosh Baruch Hu, noticing HaKadosh, the focus is on noticing HaKadosh Baruch Hu Behester. This is the end of the period of Nevuah. Gemara comments in Zvachin, HaKadosh Baruch Hu really would have ended Nevuah by this point, but in order to smooth the process of being by Hashem, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us three more Nevi'im, Chagai, Zechariah, Malachi, to accompany the Jews back to Eretz Yisrael. This is basically the end. We're basically at the end of Nevuah. And Rabbi Tzadok talks about as well, this is really the as the Seder Olam comments, this is a Megillas Esther is right around the time when the focus, the Dagesh Chazak of Klal Yisrael's creative energies is switching from Tarshu B'Chsav to Tarshu B'Peh. Tarshu B'Chsav will continue to be learned, but there'll be the center of gravity, as it were, of our creative energies is shifting towards Torah Shabbat Peh. Torah Shabbat had been learned, had been developed in the past as well, but the Seder Olam says, you know, up until this point, the main creative energy of Klal Yisrael nationally was in Nevuah, in creating new works of Tanakh. From this point on, we can continue to learn Tanakh, but mikan ve'elach hat aznachal divrei chachamim. There could be an even greater emphasis than in the past on the focus on limud Torah Shabbat Peh. We don't have the time, this is sort of out of the scope of our framework right now, but maybe perhaps for some other time. I think there's a brisker Rav as it develops an approach based on Rambam to some of the detailed halachas of the Megillah, Sirtut, how the Megillah is fabricated and published, how you make a Megillah, how you produce a Megillah. I think captures this as a philosophy of the halacha of that Lamda, I think captures this as well, that the Megillah represents fully Torah, but sort of one foot out of the world of Torah Shebichsav. And more on that maybe some other time. So you're right. Purim, so it's coming back to the Gemara and Megillah. Purim is Sof Kol HaNisim, just like Shachar Sof HaLaila. So that's a strange description. The end of Nisim is the end of the night? I would think the Nisim are day. Nisim represent a clarity about HaKadosh Baruch Hu. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is more evident when you have a Nis. So why are we describing Purim as the end of the period of Nisim, as we were just developing in the last couple of minutes, that Purim is Sof Kol HaNisim? How does that correspond to the end of night? It's dawn. You would think that would make Purim dusk. So Chaim Freelander and Sifsei Chaim quotes perhaps a Maral, that it's because of this Ramban. Excuse me, he doesn't quote Maral, but he does reference that Ramban, the end of Bo. That the higher level of Avoda is to not only notice HaKadosh Baruch Hu Nisim Gluyim, that's meant to bring me, Ramban writes, to the higher level of even noticing HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the Nisim Nistarim. So there was, clearly there were so many aspects of profundity of Avos Hashem that were present during the period of Nevuah that were not, or were less present afterwards. But at the same time, there's something that we have now that we didn't have before, or didn't have as much of before, and that's the capacity to be Ovid Hashem without Nisim Gluyim. The capacity to be Ovid Hashem without Nevuah. That is, and you're right, Chaim, that's what our Gemara is capturing as well. That's an added level, an added layer to our Avos Hashem, is the fact that that we live in with this higher level of Kabbalah's HaTorah, the Chadra Kiblu B'Meach HaShverish. I would have loved, I see our time is just about done, and that is Baruch Hashem for the best of reasons, because this was even more interactive than I had hoped. Yeah, I came into this thinking that, what's it going to be like? We're going to be in a screen, and you know, but the Zoom Shir and Baruch Hashem can work and can work well. But then I was imagining, you know, every participant in the Shir would be on his own screen. Then I came, I saw you guys all on one big screen, so that really makes it hard that could be a mechitza hamavdelas, you know, in terms of participation. Baruch Hashem, you're on fire. And this was even more participatory than I could have imagined. That was amazing. Amazing, amazing. Let me just, for the next couple of minutes, I know there's more to say about this Gemara, I just want to sort of put this into a framework and maybe point you towards other agadas you may want to look at in parallel and in counterpoint. What we've been doing, what we've been learning over the last close to an hour, and we're focused on 15-20 lines of Agada Shabbos Peches Amud Aleph, exploring the nuance. We saw both of process and of content and the interplay, process and content in the Psukim Tanakh, process and content in the Agada. And learning, as we said at the beginning, learn Agada seriously. Learn Agada seriously. And just to put this into framework, I had mentioned we're not going to have the chance, Baruch Hashem, because for the best of reasons, we had the opportunity to invest so much time in this one Agada. We're not, and the Maharal's comment on it. We're not going to have the chance now, although I certainly recommend you take a look at a Gemara in Sota on Daf Hei Amud Beis. It appears in Moed Katan Daf Hei Amud Aleph as well. Hashomer Chosov Ba'olam Hazeh, which Ramchal very subtly and elegantly treats at the end of the second parak of Mesilas Yesharim. I mentioned before that the Ramchal has an essay, a short essay, beautiful essay, in which he talks about the different categories of Agada. You know, we often think about Ramchal as being primarily a Mekubal. And to many people, you would think that the Ramchal and the Rambam are diametrically opposed. The truth is, we don't have time to talk about this now, but the biography of the Ramchal is a topic that's very close to my heart. And he was a fascinating man, and a very multivalent, multifaceted, multidimensional man, the Ramchal. In many ways, his story was somewhat similar to the Rambam. They were both incredibly controversial during their lifetime, and remarkably widely accepted beyond. The Ramchal even more quickly than the Rambam. Within a couple of decades, the Ramchal was kicked halfway across Europe, put into Kher multiple times, and yet within a couple of decades of his passing, he lived in the first half of the 1700s, the latter half of the 1700s, obviously one of the great intellectual chasms for Klal Yisrael in the late 1700s was the split between the Hasidim and Misnagdim, and yet on both sides, within a couple of decades of the death of the Ramchal, the early Hasidim and the Vilna Gaon are both firmly, fervently attached to Ramchal. Remarkable. And there are other ways in which he's similar to the Rambam. Not just that they were both controversial during their lifetime. Rav Chatzkel Sarna, in his introduction to his edition of Mesilas Yesharim, points out that structurally, the bent of mind and the sense of organization are common to both Rambam, particularly in his Mishneh Torah, and to Ramchal, particularly in many of his Svarim. And I would say for now, particularly in his Mamar al Ha'agados, we don't have time to deal with it extensively, but the first thing he does in very Maimonidean style is to say, let's take all their goddesses and Sha'as and let's begin to categorize them. So he says, some of them deal with Musar. He says, first, some deal with understanding, with making sense of the Tanakh, Misbar Krai. And others deal with are topical, are thematic. Within the thematic ones, we can subdivide the thematic agados into those which deal with Musar and those that deal with Machshava or Kabbalah. And he points out that in general, the ones that deal with Musar will be straightforward, while the ones that deal with Kabbalah, or maybe more broadly Machshava, tend to be metaphoric or allegorical. So you think about, and then he begins to talk about the tools you would use for the various types of, and the sensitivity you need to have in seeking to understand various types of agados in a sophisticated fashion. I should note that I believe it's Yosef Avivi, in his epilogue to the Ofek edition of Mesilas Yesharim, who points out that the Ramchal wrote whole Svarim built around these different subcategories of Agada. That Mesilas Yesharim is a Mishneh Torah, as it were, of the Agadas of Musar. By Mishneh Torah, I mean, as in the Mishneh Torah, taking the comments throughout the Talmud Bavli, which are organized, you know, conversationally, the Rambam takes them and puts them back into strict logical order. The Ramchal does that in Mesilas Yesharim. He takes all the agados of that subcategory of the Musar agados that are spread throughout Shas and puts them into a very logical and useful organizational scheme. Derech Hashem and perhaps some other works are focused on not the Musar Agadas, but the different subcategory of the Agadas of Machshav, the Agadas of Kabbalah, the Agadas that focus not on how a Jew grows towards Ribbono Shalom, but how HaKadosh Baruch Hu is Mashpi upon us, not Masa Merkava, but Masa Bereishis. And Derech Hashem is a highly organized, incredibly organized treatment of that subcategory of Agados. And now let's think for a moment, using these categories of thought with which Ramchal gifts us, let's think for a moment about where we've been and where we might go. We were focused over the course of this hour on Shabbos Peches, on an Agada that clearly fits into the Machshava subcategory, and not in terms of content, but in terms of style, clearly, as particularly in the hands of the Maharal, a lot of melitza, a lot of metaphor and delicate use of language. We don't have time now, but I would recommend, I know you learn Masachas Sotah and Bekiyas, I would recommend that you review Hayim Beis, Shamar Chosav, the comment that the Gemara has, both Sotah Daf Hei and Mo'ekot and Daf Hei, on a pasuk in, I believe it Telem Daf Perek Nun, V'sam Derech Arenu, how the Gemara understands it, and the delicacy of how the Ramchal, with just a few lines, without making a big deal of it, points out that there's such nuance in reading both halves of that one line Agada. So that would be moving from a Machshava Gemara that's metaphoric to a Musar Agada, which is straightforward, and even in that straightforwardness, there is, as Ramchal subtly points out in the Perek Beis Mesilas Yesharim, a tremendous amount of nuance. And finally, had we had time, let me give you a drop more homework. I know you're learning Bava Basra and Iyun. And Bava Basra, of course, in the Perek HaMocheres HaSfina, the fifth Perek, there's an extensive chunk of highly metaphorical Agada, very non-straightforward Agada, the whole series of stories that the tales that Rabbi Bar Bar Chana conveys, mostly from the sailors. The Vilna Gaon has a fantastic little kuntres, Perish Al-Kama Agadas, where he spends his time in large part on those agados of Rabbi Bar Chana in the fifth parak of Maseches Bava Basra. And in the third agada, the agada of Hermann ben Lilas, it's Tosfos in Sanhedrin references that Gemara in Bava Basra. It's seasonal. If you bear in mind that this is the end of December is certainly a time of Christian focus on Christian theology. There's a fascinating Agada in Sanhedrin, Lametes Amid Aleph. The Gemara, you know, the Christians tell the story of the three magi who supposedly show up to baby Yeshu and his family. The three magi, properly translated, it's not wise men nor is it kings. A magus, or plural is magi or magi, were priests of the Zoroastrian religion. They appear by that name as well as several places in Shas, including Sanhedrin Daf Lama Tesam and Aleph, where the Gemara speaks of an amgusha, that's a magus, that's the singular of magi, an amgusha who has a theological discussion with Amemar. And Tosvos comments that the terminology overlaps with Hurman Bar Lilisa, Bava Basra, Ein Gimel, and Aleph. That's the very beginning of those Agados in Perek HaMochos, Hasfina, Bava Basra. We don't have time, but perhaps some other time we'll have the opportunity, or you'll have the opportunity on your own, or perhaps by Zeering, to explore. This is a third type of Agada. Because Shabbos Peches was Machshava, the content was Machshava, and the style was Melitza. Sota Daf Hei, the content is Musar, and the style is more straightforward. Here, the content is once again Machshava, and I would suggest, as the Gra does, the Gra quotes his Gemara in Sanhedrin in his comments on that Gemara in Bava Basra and Gimel, points out this is theologically profound. This is also very central Agada to our understanding of Olam HaZeh and Olam HaBa, and what differentiates the Jewish approach from the Christian and initially Zoroastrian dualist approach on the one extreme and the hedonistic approach on the other extreme. This Agada is very straightforward and very profound and nuanced. And it's a fundamental statement in Sanhedrin Lama Tess, is presented straightforward. In Bava Basra Ayin Gimel, is presented in the form of a Melitza. But both of them are in the world of Machshava, very central concepts in theology. I hope this has whetted your appetite to further explore Agada, and particularly with the insights of the Maharal, the Ramchal, and the Gra. I want to thank Rabbi Zeering again for this opportunity to get together the Chevra and learn. Halavai that we will have opportunities, the Kadosh Baruch Hu should be good to us, we'll have opportunities to get together face to face.